Hello and welcome to the 3W6 podcast from the little world called Vienna, season 11, episode 12.
My name is Howard.
And my name is Marcus.
We're here to talk about narrative pen and paper role-playing games.
And our guest today is Ben Robbins, designer of In This World.
Hello, glad to be here.
Yeah, welcome to the podcast, Ben. In the unlikely case that listeners haven't heard your name before, could you give us a quick intro?
Let's see. I, for a long time, play D&D, things like that. People might have heard of me from West Marches, which was a D&D campaign that I ran that got kind of experimental. And from that experimentation, I kind of shifted over into a much more niche, a smaller subset of role-playing games, which is GM-less games, where the focus is really on everyone at the table having an equal say in what happens. But not only having equality, but having, let's say, fruitful equality, like having equality where everybody still enjoys it. Like, it's easy to all disagree, but so the games I make are intentionally designed to help people overcome the difficulties of making something creative that everybody at the table enjoys together.
Curious question, why did you make that shift? What kind of prompted it?
I'll tell you, I used to tell people like, I just one day I bumped into these new games and I started playing them. And then I kind of stopped and looked at my own history and I realized that was a complete lie. That wasn't true at all. That in fact, going back 12 years before that, so I started playing D&D in like 1980. And then I played for about 13, 14 years and was just GMing all the time. And it was 100%, you know, this is my world, this is my stuff. And I was just constantly GMing in all these different groups playing together, you know, classic GM. And then a couple things happened that weren't satisfying. Players weren't happy. I wasn't happy. And I began to kind of dig into what is it that I'm not enjoying at this point? What's not going right? And I ran a series of over the next 12 years, because that's how I operate. I go in big chunks of time. Over the next 12 years, I ran three different campaigns that were experimental that kind of, and I didn't know what I was doing at the time, but in hindsight, it makes a lot of sense, where I kind of just changed the way we did things. Radically so. In the middle one of those is West Marches. That's the one where instead of having players in a party, I let the players decide where they wanted to go, what they wanted to do. And the game happened because they had a plan. They wanted it to happen. So they were leading the initiative. So like each one of these three things was like an attempt to kind of like shift the balance so that it wasn't me running the game. It was like, well, what if I let the players do this part? Or what if we handed this to the other people? So kind of feeling my way around. And that then, I think each one of those was interesting in its own way. Some were total failures, but some were successful. But that then led me to the point. Then when I did bump into GM-less games, I was like, yeah, this is kind of what I want to do. I want to go all the way and actually, you know, have everyone be equal participants, right? Share the fun of the world creation process or not even the world creation process, but share the fun of deciding what the story is about. Because it's socially weird, honestly, to be like, hey, let's come to this table, but I'm going to tell you a story, you know? I mean, it's kind of strange. If you explain it to somebody who's never played D&D, they're like, really? I just listen like, yeah, I'm gonna lay it out for you. You know, and you're gonna make some decisions, but ultimately, you know, here's the story we're gonna do, so.
Before we dig deeper into your games, I've done some digging on you and your biography, and I read somewhere, I think it might have been in Designers and Dragons, that you wrote your thesis on tabletop RPGs. Is that true?
Yes, it is.
Can you talk about that?
It is. It's great. Actually, this is one of like, I think this thesis holds water. I think this actually, to this day, I still see evidence that this is true. And so this is like a million years ago. You know, I was supposed to do my senior thesis and I was supposed to do it on one topic and I was miserable and I didn't like it. And my advisor was like, okay, well, you're going to go. And then I just came to him one weekend. I was like, hey, look, I don't want to do this topic. I want to do this other topic. I want to do it about role-playing games, D&D. And my thesis advisor had no idea what I was talking about and said, okay, whatever. Sure. Let's, if you want to. But the core question the hypothesis I had, was that, and this will take a little explaining, but this is actually a very simple concept, is that if you imagine that there is the degree to which we as individual people are comfortable with who we are, what we'll call like self-acceptance, like are you happy with yourself, right? There's that as one axis. And I'm gesturing with my hand. We're on audio, but this is me gesturing to like an axis with my hand. And then the other axis is the degree to which characters you play in a game are similar or different from yourself. So you might play a character who is like, yeah, this is basically me, but in the fantasy world, right? The personality is the same, right? Versus people who play characters that are wildly different from themselves. Like, I'm an introvert, but my character is very outgoing and, you know, very whatever. And my theory was that if you looked at those, that curve, like all the way from like, I'm not comfortable with myself and I play a character that's not like, or it is not like myself, all the way to the exact opposite end, what you would see is a curve where, my theory was, you'd see a curve where if you had very low self-acceptance, if you weren't comfortable with yourself, you didn't like who you were, you would play characters that are very different from yourself. Because like, hey, it's escapism. I can be someone else, right? That's awesome. And then on the other far end, if you were very, very comfortable with yourself, you would also play characters that were very different because you would be comfortable. You'd be like, oh, sure, I'll do something different. Why not for fun? Because you wouldn't be threatened by playing someone else. You'd be comfortable playing someone else. But then in the middle, if you had like, if you weren't, you know, you're still figuring things out, or like you're comfortable with yourself, but you know, you're still working on things, you might wind up playing characters that were very like yourself because you're just kind of still practicing being yourself, and you're not quite comfortable enough to try to be someone else, and you're not uncomfortable enough to want to escape. So you hit this kind of middle band. And so basically it's like a bell curve, right? So if you're low self-acceptance or very high self-acceptance, you're going to play people very different. And if you're in the middle, you play people very like yourself. And that was my theory. And I did I did a whole bunch of like surveys with people and tests and did multivariate data analysis. And it kind of like showed up, but there was not enough people in the sample. It was like, you know, a little college experiment. So I didn't have enough data to prove it conclusively or to show that it was not just an artifact of the data. But from playing with people to this day, I see that like a lot. Like you see, here's a very important thing. There's nothing wrong with any of this stuff. I just think it's awesome that role-playing games can serve very different purposes for different people. Like, why are you doing? What are you getting out of it? Like, it might be something totally different than the person next to you is getting out of it. And I think we all have those people we know who are like, oh my God, that person always plays the same character. You know, they always play the same person. And like, yeah, maybe they do, but maybe that's what they wanted to. Maybe that's what they need to do. Like that's cool. That's fine. There's not a problem with it. But I just think it's interesting to think that we think of that as like, well, they're not really taking advantage of the possibilities of role-playing games, but maybe they really are. Maybe they're actually getting a lot out of that.
That's a really fascinating lens, because it also kind of like really wipes with my like overall life experience. If you play with people for 30 years, you notice this curve happening. That's really fascinating.
Yeah. And it's
what was your subject actually? What was your major?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, it was technically psychology. And it was psychology. I became a psychology major because that allowed me to do a whole bunch of stuff. I could do classics and anthropology. I had a much wider latitude. Oh, and the funny sub-story of this is that after I did all this study, and I was all ready, and I had all this entire discussion we're having, I was ready with this argument, and I went in for my oral defense to talk to these, you know, the advisors and the other professors and explain, you know, to defend my conclusions. And all they wanted to know about was how D&D worked. They were like, so wait, you say I'm walking down a road and there's a crow? How do I know there's a crow? We spent like an hour just explaining D&D. And every time I would be like, okay, good, right? Let's get back to my thesis. They'd be like, but wait, what is my character? If I'd have known, it would have been the easiest oral defense ever. I'd be like, hey, everybody, roll up
the character. You should have just whipped out the character sheets.
I didn't anticipate it.
Let's go.
Yeah, I kept changing the subject and being like, okay, good, right? You get it, right? You're talking to a crow. Move on. Yeah. Yeah, it was very funny.
So good. So let's get back to your game. So you're probably best known for Microscope, and it has been, if I'm correct, 13 years since that came out.
Yeah, it has.
How do you see that game today?
I love Microscope. I still think, so Microscope, I even started it like properly 2008. I think the very first playtest was the beginning of 2009. It was unbelievably educational, right? Figuring out whether it was doing what I wanted to do, et cetera. And when I play it now, I have like I can do the patter of like, here's how we play Microscope. Just, it's like ingrained in my memory. But I wonder now if the book isn't as, the book is not as concise as I am now, right? I make my games smaller and smaller and smaller. I try to make the text less and less and less because I want to say like two sentences to tell you exactly what to do. I don't want you to have to read through like three pages because you're sitting at the table, you're trying to play. You don't want to read three pages. You want to play the game, right? So like if you look at In This World by comparison, the text or even like Follow, In This World, The New Kingdom, they're all tighter and tighter and tighter. So I feel that like Microscope is, the game itself is awesome. But if I were writing it again now, I would be like, I can make that, like that paragraph half as long. I could tighten that up a little bit more. Fundamentally, the actual core play of the game, I think works great, except the one thing that I think is not 100% there is the scenes. I think that the scenes, because they're written, they're too slow to leap into. And so a lot of people skip them. A lot of people just make history because, as I've said before, other times, like, there's lots of games where you get to play scenes, but there's not a lot of games where you get to like just make up a whole world and create whole historical events. So people naturally gravitate towards the big part of the game, to like, I'm going to say how the entire war turns out or what the planet is like. And they will leave out the scenes. But I think it is critically important to do both ends of the spectrum, to do the big world creation aspects, but also do the very human parts where you see people dealing with these issues directly. Like you see those moments where somebody like turns their back on their brother, you know, stuff like that, to really kind of like connect the whole thing together to give the big world events context. So I think that's the one thing, is that the scenes need to be more streamlined and more concise in certain ways, which I am working on. I've been hammering away at that because I feel like those need to be simpler, just to make it give you the full both ends of the spectrum. So
Microscope second edition is coming?
Well, I don't tell anybody. I haven't seriously thinking about that. There's always like which of these things in the fire is going to come out first. Sometimes you're surprised. Like sometimes you work on things for a long time and they don't go anywhere. You just can't get them to work. Other times things are like In This World just kind of came out of, well, I had been struggling with it for a long time and then suddenly it worked and I could just whip it out, and like, because I had thought about it for so long. So yeah, I've been thinking about, don't tell anybody, but I'm thinking about a new edition of Microscope and it will be awesome. And it'll be three pages long.
On the other hand, is it fair to say that with In This World, you're sort of revisiting Microscope, or at least that idea of building worlds?
It's interesting. Like, here's what's interesting. If you said to somebody, hey, this is a game about, I don't know, pirates, right? We're going to all be pirates, right? And you might be immediately envisioning a certain kind of game. Like, oh, I'm going to roll up a character. I'm going to do whatever. Someone else might be envisioning a different type of game where it's like, oh, this is going to be talking about the story of pirate fleets and how the nations, whatever. There are like a lot of different ways to skin a cat. There's a lot of different ways to approach the same subject matter. So like, while from a great, great distance, In This World and Microscope are both about making worlds. I'm air quoting. Nobody can see this. I'm making air quotes. They're both about making worlds. The way you're doing it is radically different. So it's like, from a very great distance, they might be in the same category, but they're really not at all. Just the process by which you do it. And that's not even leaving alone the whole thing of like, within this world, you're making multiple separate fictional iterations, whereas Microscope is all about like, can we all stay on the same page the entire time? But yeah, you do come back to similar ideas, but wildly different in execution, similar in philosophy. How about that? I'll stick with that answer.
Yeah, let's talk about that process, because I always felt like your games work equally well if you look at them as like a creative workshop method.
Yeah.
And with In This World, you use a tried and tested creativity tool, which is you take something that's so obvious you don't even question it, and then you turn it on its head.
Yeah.
So I love that this is in that game. Was that like the first spark for your game?
Not exactly. Well, I mean, the spark was to say like, you know, there's things that we just accept as normal and we don't question, but did they have to be that way? The very volatile example I gave that just stuck in my head for a long time was like, if you didn't know anything about religion and I told you about, say, Christianity, and this is not going to be insulting to any religion. This is just like, it's weird. And you said to somebody like, yeah, the principle is that, you know, like God created the earth and you know, made it for humanity, but created the Earth. You would think, oh, those people would also be big time environmentalists, right? They'd be like all about preserving nature and about endangered species and all this stuff, because you'd say like, oh, those are people who believe that like the world is like the sacred place. And yet in the real world, that's generally like in America, for example, that's not the connection. You, someone who is, if you took the Venn diagram of people who were like conservatively religious and people who were environmentalists, and it's not really overlapping, which is weird, but it's more to the point to like that there's things you go, it didn't have to be this way. It's not that it's either better or worse. It's just that some things we think of as being unavoidable or like absolutely the way things must be are not really unavoidable. They're the result of a bunch of different things that happened in our particular world, but things could have been quite different with just a slight tweak. So that was really the thing about it, the looking at the world with kind of more open eyes. That was the goal, I would say, with making it. And the thing that stuck with me the longest time that stopped the game dead was that I hadn't thought of the idea of doing the multiple worlds. And so it was just like, well, if you just make one world questioning, you know, environmentalism or whatever, how do you make that interesting, right? And I kept in this roadblock of like, all we're doing is debating which choice we want to make. How do you decide whose choice is best? And that sucks. That's no fun. And so then the idea of like, wait, we could just make a bunch of worlds and each one's just a little experiment and we can move on and everyone has the freedom to just like do whatever and see what happens was incredibly freeing and suddenly made the game like instantly fun. Whereas it had been a roadblock in my head for just years gone by. So
is it fair to say that inverting expectations is kind of like a through line through most or all of your games?
I don't know. I don't know what expectations are. I think, okay, I would say no. Well, here's what it is. Here's what I want to do. Here's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to get people to look at the ideas other people have and go, hey, that was a cool idea. I didn't think of that. I like that. And therefore, I think you're a more interesting person than I thought you were a minute ago. It's to get people to surface ideas that they might not otherwise surface. So in a way, that's not exactly inverting expectations, but it's getting people to... it's getting people to show things that are in their mind that they might not otherwise bring out, way to put it, and to let other people appreciate those things. That's what I'm shooting for. Even if the result is boring, I don't care. If the result is like we just recreated Star Wars, that's fine with me, so long as the people at the table like how they got there. See what I mean?
Yeah, totally. I'm just wondering, maybe it's just me, but when I play your games, it usually leads to me coming up with stuff that I surprise myself with.
Yes. But have you told those stories to other people?
Obviously, it gets better if you tell this to other people. And sometimes, I mean, with story games in general, it's like you come up with an idea you think is boring and everybody else is totally amazed by it.
Yes.
And that's kind of like the difference, because in your games, I usually come up with ideas I surprise myself with as well.
Yes. No, that's me too. That's why I play these games. I love, well, multiple reasons, but I love the fact that I will go into a game with no ideas. Somebody will say something and my brain will click and I'll go, wait, what about this? And I can feel myself being creative in the moment. And I love that. It's like, I didn't pre-plan this. I didn't sit for weeks and think of this. This is just me on the moment. And it makes you feel really good about yourself. Like, oh, so I was just creative right then. But that's like one possible outcome. The other possible outcome, just like you described, is the thing where the person says something and I go, oh, this isn't really a good idea, but I'll throw it out there. And because they have to. And they say an idea and they think it's boring and the rest of us love it. And we all go, oh, that's awesome. I'm going to build on it. And then they're happy because they go, oh, I didn't think my idea was good, but you guys liked it. So now I'm excited. So I think both of those, like those two possibilities and a million possibilities in between are all great and all work together. Which is what I like about it compared to a more traditional game where it's like, if my contribution isn't good, that's it. Like, everyone's like, no, that wasn't that great. You know, we don't really have a way to build on it. So we don't get this kind of like snowballing effect where we all interact. But what I was going to say before is that like, sometimes you make you have a great game. It's fantastic. But if you were to then tell someone else who wasn't at the game the story, they would go, that's not really that creative. And you're like, no, but it was the way we got there. Like the things we did got us there. We're really interested. Exactly right. Yeah. It's the process you go through is the important part, not just the end result. That the end result might be completely, like, Microscope is a great example because you're telling the history out of order. The end result might be pretty straightforward, but you're like, oh, we never knew we were going there. We got there unexpectedly. And so to us, the people at the table, it's very exciting, which is what matters, right? Not that you made a good book in the end. So,
and I think you give good structure to that because it's not a freewheeling discussion about what this world is all about. It's right. Everybody's taking turns, and you also give clear instructions not to interrupt and let people form their ideas. And I see that more and more in narrative games, that you have sort of a turn-taking structure or at least instructions to make sure that everybody gets their spotlight or gets their moment to state their idea clearly and build on each other's ideas. So I think that's very interesting that those kind of rules can then maybe also add to that sort of workshop character I mentioned.
It's a big challenge. And in fact, initially in Microscope, those very strict, like, it's not your turn, don't talk, was directed at me. That those were me writing rules for myself to say, like, I always have ideas. I'm always like, you could do this, you could do this, you could do this. And I recognized, like, no, that's not going to help. Like, just giving other people suggestions does not help. That actually ruins the entire game. The beauty of it is the surprise. It's the, I'm surprised. I can't be surprised by my own ideas if I'm not surprised by your ideas. I have to, like, let you say something. If I'm just talking and telling everybody what to say, then what are we doing? That's really no fun. So a variety of ways to try to change the social dynamic and not just be whoever talks the most, creates the most. And like taking turns and just saying, hey, everyone else wait. It's crude. I mean, it's a pretty crude way to do it, but it works. I mean, I'm sure there's better ways that we'll discover in the year 2050, but right now this is a good start. So
it also feels like this is almost a necessity for the whole GM-less part.
Yes.
Because getting everybody to the same like level makes building on each other's ideas much more interesting than if you have one person that's driving the story.
Absolutely. No, that's absolutely right. Yeah. And it's the people. So I ran Story Game Seattle for like 8 years and played with like a bunch of random people every week. So I would see tons of just random people come in and play and try these kind of games. And the thing that happened, the only person I would ever see, well, the person who I'd see who would struggle with it the absolute most would be somebody who was like a dyed-in-the-wool, very experienced game master who was used to being like, I am a game master. I know how to do this thing. And they sometimes, not all of them, but some people would have a very hard time relinquishing control. And also they would be, because the structure is different, like they have to respond to other people, they are just not used to that. And they would be so used to their other way of doing things that it just wouldn't work. And they'd be stumped. And they would be so upset because they were in their head, they're like, I am a gamer. I'm very good at gaming. And then they'd struggle and they would be like, this can't be right. I'm supposed to be good at this. And people would have very strong emotional responses to that at times. You know, what are you going to do? It's like, you got to be like this. It's a different activity. It's like saying you're good at baseball, but now you're going to play volleyball. They're not the same thing. So you got to embrace that the pattern is changing.
Maybe it's not your games that are inverting expectations, like in the text, but on Microscope, I checked on the cover, it still says role-playing game.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And so you definitely invert people's expectations. Yes. About what role-playing games are with your games.
So I would say, Vincent Baker has a great definition of role-playing games, which I'm probably going to get wrong, but I think is what it is. And his definition is that a role-playing game, right? Because back in the day, D&D didn't call itself a role-playing game. It was like an adventure gaming thing, right? So we like to think that was like the original term, but I'm not sure that really was, right? And we also think like literally, oh, it says role-playing, therefore you must be role-playing, but that's not how it works, right? Baseball, you know, has bases, but it's not like if, you know, that's not the definition of it. That's what we call it. But his definition of role-playing games, which I think is a great definition, is that a role-playing game is a game where you must have an agreement about what the fiction is. And if you stop agreeing about the fiction, like what is happening in the imaginary world, the game cannot proceed. So if you think of like, Gloomhaven or HeroQuest, some like board game where it's like, oh, I've got a little character and I'm moving them around. It doesn't matter what I think is happening fictionally because the board says I'm right here, right? I could have any imagination I want. It doesn't matter because the board strictly determines what's going on. But if I'm playing D&D and the GM says you walk into the bottom floor of a tower, and I don't think I did, the game is going to crash very quickly, right? We don't agree about what this fictional world is. And I think that more so than the, are you playing a character or stuff like that? That's the critical bit, that they're games of imagination where we have to agree on fiction together. And there's nothing holding us to the fiction. There's nothing on the table making the fiction true, right? I'm looking at the table. I don't see something telling me I went in a tower. It's just that we are all imagining the same thing. And I think that's really the core of like all role-playing games, that regardless of combat or characters or anything else, if we can't agree on the fiction, it stops.
I think you just described something that I struggled with for years, and that is, it's totally what you said. You have agreed to the fiction, but the details of the fiction in everybody's head can be wildly different.
Yes.
It's just the baseline you have to agree to, and the rest can be super personalized and make it a very exciting experience, even if you have different ideas than others.
And what's funny is people have no idea that's happening. I love you go through an entire game and you think you're imagining the exact same thing, but you might be slightly off or you might be very off, but those probably aren't the details that are critical. It's like, I'm picturing this person being tall. You're picturing them being short. That's fine. We can probably be okay with that. But sometimes you then suddenly realize like, oh, wait, we were imagining this differently, and it collides and it breaks down and everything falls apart. Like a game I played a brief demo, Ron Edwards, the guy who made Sorcerer, who's like a godfather of indie role-playing games, right? Really began the charge of indie role-playing games, you know, ran the Forge, all this stuff. I played a brief demo with him at a Gen Con once, and we were sitting down to play Thou Art a Warrior, which is a hack of Polaris where you're playing like Saracen Knights in Spain, whatever. The point is you're playing like kind of a medieval setting, and we're doing a quick demo. We're sitting down to play, and this thing happens where one character, the main character who's off to my left, their no good brother is basically just being an ass in town. It's basically just making a fool of themselves and embarrassing everybody. And this knight, who's kind of a very noble figure, very dignified figure, sees this and is like, oh, I have to do something to stop my brother from making a fool of himself, right? And Ron Edwards is playing the brother and just being a fool. And I'm playing the like lieutenant of this knight. And I am immediately like, oh, my knight is going to have to like beat up his brother to get him in order. And I know he doesn't want to do that, so I'm going to do it. So as his minion, I describe like, you know, pouncing on the brother and beating the crap out of him. And Ron Edwards keeps describing things he's saying, whatever. And then I realize like 2 minutes later, he has misunderstood what I said. And he thinks I'm saying I'm beating up this other character. So in his mind, I have pounced on this other guy and he's still just talking to his brother. And in my mind, I am beating the crap out of him and he is just ignoring me and going about his business and still having a conversation. And it was a great like, oh yeah, this is like textbook. We all think we're on the same page, but we've missed one important detail and we're totally on the wrong page. And now the game is going to suddenly crash to a halt because what we think is happening in the fiction doesn't link up at all. And it was great. And it was like maybe 10 minutes of gaming, but it was beautifully educational. And it's like no one's fault, but it was like, yeah, that's really the deal. If we don't agree to what is physically happening, you know, the brakes come on, the lights turn on, the whole game stops.
I don't know how to segue back to In This World, but I'm just going to do it. You got off the path a little bit, but it was really instructional. So back to In This World.
I do say Ron Edwards is great, is incredibly fun to play with. So I just want to say it was so much fun playing with him, but that was very funny still.
We got to get him on sometime. I think he even lives in Europe, right?
Oh, yeah, he did. He moved somewhere. I don't really know him that well. I mean, I've met him a couple of times, but I do recall something about that, yeah.
So, In This World. Again, about the procedures, which are really interesting to me, because you also start the procedure by saying, hey, do not jump to the idea generation immediately. You need to talk about those statements and you need to have some clarity And basically, you need to do some brainstorming before that. And you make it very clear, don't jump into the game as such immediately. Why is that?
It's very important that you start, the whole concept of the game is you start with the real world before you make a fictional world. And we all have to agree what is true in the real world. And so that whole first step, or first three steps really, are what is normally true? What is normally true? Don't make anything up yet. We're not being creative at all. We're just saying, like, hey, how does clothing work in the real world? Let's just say ordinary things about clothing. And it's very intentionally so that we're just establishing, like, basic facts. We're not leaping to the next stage yet. And what you're describing is when sometimes people will be like, wait, I have an idea. So I'll say something weird about clothing so then I can say, like the classic example, like wolves don't fly, you know, wolves don't normally fly, but in this world they do. And you're like, well, wolves flying or not is not really about the real world. It's like you're already jumping ahead to the creative bit. You're pre-playing the game instead of actually still dealing with the normal facts. And if you jump ahead like that, you start saying things that aren't really statements about the real world. You're already making words up. And so you miss, I think, exploring the facts that we're trying to examine in the first place, right? You start becoming fantastical. And that might be okay for you, but you've kind of taken away some of the raw material from other players as well, of like things that would be true in the real world. So yeah, very important. First part, just real world, no creativity. And also the reason we do that in the game in general is because that makes being creative easier. You spend all this time, you know, 20 minutes talking about the real world. And every time you say something like, you know, clothing is made of, you know, textiles or whatever, every statement you make, even if you're not conscious of anything, it's getting your brain thinking about the nature of this thing, the topic you've picked. So you're gearing up. And that's what that entire process is for, is to kind of like prime the pump and get you ready to then be creative about it. It's to build a scaffolding that you're going to use later on. And obviously people will always be like, wait, I got an idea. I could jump ahead. But that's not the idea, right? You got to wait. Like, wait for it. You can go first, but wait for it.
Yeah. And what's also really interesting is that you make those multiple worlds, but what struck me is you make those multiple worlds with the same statements again and again. Yes. You use the same materials over and over again. And that was the really surprising bit to me when I read. I actually had to read it twice to understand it because I probably was reading too quickly.
No, people have done it wrong. People have played it the other way where they just like, oh, they went back and made a new topic and started over again. And I was like, no, the whole point is that you're looking at the same idea through different lenses. You're like, okay, well, we said that about this idea. What if we did something different? You're kind of comparing and contrasting. And so that way that gives you the freedom to be like, well, we just did a really serious take on this topic. What if we did a more lighthearted take? What if we did a more dark take? What if we did, you know, it lets you kind of see the same idea a lot of different ways. And again, that's really the whole point of the game, is to give you the freedom to be like, well, I don't know if this is the best idea ever, but it's going to be something different from what we did last time. And so people feel less pressure to make something that is amazing because they know they're just like making something, maybe just trying to make something different from the last time. And that is literally the whole point of the structure, is to make people more relaxed about being creative.
In your designer notes, you basically state that you want to make the game deep and easy, which feels kind of like the holy grail of hard to do things.
Yeah, yeah.
So it feels more like a visionary mission statement than an easy to achievable goal.
Yeah.
just tell us more about it.
It's exactly because the starting point was I want people to kind of think about the world and question their assumptions, right? I want people to think about what they don't think about, right? But then you're like, well, there's no point doing that if nobody does it, right? There's no point making a technique that nobody tries. So yeah, exactly. I was like, well, how can I make people really kind of like open their brains, but make it super easy to open your brain? So, right. It was initially, this is why I took it. There was a long time when I couldn't get this game figured out. But I think those are probably the two major things, right? The one is because you're starting from the real world, right? Okay. Point of comparison, like microscope. A flaw of microscope is that the very first step says, hey, pick a big picture. Just out of the blue, pick a giant thing that you're going to talk about. And it doesn't really lead you into that very well. It's just kind of like, because I'm like, well, we have a lot of ground to cover, right? But in hindsight, that is not a good starting point. Like that should be guided better somehow, right? And in this world, I address that very problem by saying, I'm not going to ask people to be creative right off the bat. I'm going to ask them about the real world, something they definitely know, something that it's no challenge. You're like, oh, we're talking about cars. I know about cars, right? No challenge at all. So the ease of like, hey, let's just talk about the real world for a while draws people in. They're comfortable. They know the subject matter, right? I'm not making them be creative. So it's easy, right? And then the fact that in addition to that, then you're making multiple worlds. So it's easy because you don't have to feel like what you're creating is essential. It's not the only thing you're going to make. It's not the one world we're going to create. So those two like different tricks, you could say, I think with either one of them separately, it wouldn't work or it wouldn't have the same effect. But with both of them, with Bakesy making it easy, because like, hey, this is a subject matter I know. Like I'm not quizzing you. Like, yeah, of course you know how food works. You know, what does food do? Easy, right? And then the world's being basically throwaway. Like you make a world, done. You set it aside, gives you the freedom to be like, let's try something. So those two things combined, I think sets you up to be really relaxed or like, you know, and like we play it. Here's what I love about it. When we play it, I play it with my friends all the time, different groups. And it's like, it is always the like, you know what? We're a little tired or low energy, but I would play in this world. Like I would do that because I know, and you know, this is them talking, right? They know that from zero energy, they're going to be more creative than they thought they would be. And they're going to be happy about it, right? That every time, like without fail, the only time in this world has failed for us is when we tried to do like, we did like physics. We did a complicated physics thing and everybody got too involved in like real world physics and it got pretty complicated. But other than that, it's just a very easy on-ramp to being creative.
Yeah. I was going to ask you about the tone of the game because, you know, given topics like prisons and drugs and the afterlife in this world can get pretty deep pretty quickly.
Yeah.
But there are also like lighter themes like pets and food, as you said. And you, of course, you could always add levity to your ideas anyway, just with your ideas.
And an important thing, well, I say an important thing too, is that the topic that you're picking, you're literally saying, we're going to make a world where things aren't this way. So if there's something you don't like about the world, like, you know, I don't like the way, like drug addiction, whatever, I don't like this. You're going to be like, well, but in this world, it's not going to be like that. We are going to make a different world. That's the whole point. Maybe it's better. Maybe it's worse. I mean, even if you fix something like food, you might wind up being like, let's explore if things were much, much worse. But the very point is that you can explore subject matter that you might otherwise not be happy with because you were literally going to change it. That's the idea of the game.
Would you say it generally turns out to be a hopeful game?
Here's the thing. Every individual player gets to start a world. It's up to them, right? Sometimes if things are too hopeful, people will be like, I'm going to throw a wrench in this. Like Mark, my buddy Mark will always say, I'm going to throw a wrench in things. I'm going to make things, you know, a little bit darker. Or even if in a particular world, you'll see as each person contributes, how it kind of like moves back and forth. Like somebody will be like, well, that sounds really nice, but what about this angle to it? Or like even things that aren't really necessarily darker, but are just like maybe a slightly more serious human aspect to it that we wouldn't have thought of. Like we did a bunch of dating games with dating as a topic and they were kind of fun and light, but then they'd be like, well, but let's think about this seriously. How would people actually respond to this? How would relationships unfold based on this? And then it got really good because it was like, it wasn't that it was pessimistic, but it was just a little more, we take a funny idea and make it a little more grounded and be like, oh, but yeah, people would feel this way about it. So the thing is that the game doesn't enforce any tone whatsoever. It responds to the desires of the players. And sometimes the desires of the players don't match up. And it's interesting to see this kind of like little back and forth. But again, the nice thing is that if somebody makes a very wacky, cartoony world, and that's not your thing, that's fine because you're not stuck in this world. You're going to play that world for a little bit and then you're going to make a different world. So I think it makes people more willing to jump into tones that they're not normally into. They're like, well, that's not my thing, but I know this is just one of the worlds we're going to do. So I'll do it Whereas if you were playing a more traditional game where like this was the one setting we were going to make, people would debate and argue for a while. They'd be like, well, I'd rather have something more serious, or I'd rather do this, or I'd rather do that. So having multiple worlds just avoids that entire issue, which is great. It's great.
Okay, follow-up question on tonality, because what you said before with creativity is something that is nourishing and satisfying.
Especially
if you do it. Yeah. I think it actually is, not just like sometimes, but it usually is. If you have a creative experience,
It
is that kind of like satisfying thing.
Yes.
Especially if it clicks with other people. So if it also has this component of like group feedback and you're not just creative, but your creativity is appreciated.
Yes, exactly.
And all that kind of like leads to a certain degree to a positive emotional state. But then again, the tonality of the different worlds you create can be very different, obviously.
Yeah.
So the net outcome at the end of the day, it kind of feels like this is one of the few games where you actually can't say what the tone is, even if you had certain tones in the game, because
it's like
it's all over the map all the time.
Yes. And that's part of the beauty of it is that, two things. One is that each of us walks away from the game liking different things. That's true in every game, right? You play D&D with people. Some people really like this part. Some people really like this part. People are like, I rolled a critical. It was awesome. Everybody has things that they savor and appreciate about the game. And in this world, it's just like that taken to 11, that like you might really like the serious world we did where we talked about the economics of this. And someone else might be like, oh, this part was funny. And even more so, the things that might stir your thinking about the world can be very different. Like the things that provoke your thought might be very different. And that's great. And that's totally cool. And that's the thing I realized. I didn't need everybody to be inspired by the same parts of the game. That like, if we make four worlds and you are inspired by this part and I'm inspired by this part, and we never even think about the things the other person's thinking about at 2 days later, that's fine. That's totally fine. And that's weird. Like initially I was like, no, we have to have an agreement. We have to be on the same page. Like, no, we don't. We have to make things together that agree. But what we walk away from, what we take away with us and how it changes us and the way we think, that's totally individual. That's different for everybody. And that's great. And that's, it just adapts to people. But the other thing I was going to say is the when you're creative and other people respond and you get that feeling that like, yeah, I said this a while ago, and this is like 100% true. The thing that I think makes a game a good game is when you walk away from it and you have more love and respect for the people you played with. When you literally have a better opinion of them because of the game you played together. Where you're literally like, oh, this person's kind of cool. Like, you like their ideas, you're just inspired, and you're literally like, we're kind of more friends now because I just like you more. And I've played like a zillion convention games, total strangers. And I've had that moment at the beginning where these people sit down together and you see them look at each other and they don't know each other. And they clearly kind of come from different walks of life. And you can tell they are skeptical that they are going to have fun with this other person. They will literally be kind of like looking very hesitant, their guards up. And then you play a little bit, then you play a little more, not just in this world, but any of these games, right? You play a little more, you play a little more. And before you finish the game, these people are now buddies. Like they are like, oh yeah, that thing, the cool thing. Like they now have this common, not just that they have a shared fiction that they like, but that they saw how each of them contributed to the fiction, and they built on each other's ideas. And they literally just have a better opinion of each other from playing the game together. And that is like, that's the whole thing in my mind. That's like a huge part of it, is that you like the people you play with more because you appreciate their contributions. If that doesn't happen, I don't know. It's not a winner. Not a winner for me. So
totally. Speaking of walking away from the game, I ask myself, how do you end that game? Because everybody makes a world, mm-hmm. and then you're done. Mm-hmm. And basically you have one paragraph in the game.
Yep.
Did you ever consider like doing like an ending ritual, a wrap-up discussion or something like that?
Yes. In fact, so when I still was early working on it, I didn't believe this would ever fly. People would ever accept this. And I had a whole like stage two, you make characters and explore a world. And I did all that stuff. And then I was like, wait, now this is, I could do this, but this would be a second game, or this would take another 3 hours. No, the point of this game is to be tight. The other thing I had was at one stage in the playtest, I had a discussion at the end where we all talked about which world we liked and the things we liked. We literally, like, each person said the world that was their favorite kind of thing. And that was a terrible idea because it sounds good on paper, but what's actually happening is now we're all kind of openly picking a favorite and kind of disagreeing about what we liked. And it's like that happens organically. That can't happen organically, and it's great. But when you make people do it, it kills the mood entirely. I did it for like two playtests, and I was like, oh, this is the worst idea I've ever had. It's funny how things that are very logical, when you enforce them as rules, they have a different social effect than you might think. And people do, at the end of the game, absolutely have those discussions if they want to, right? You know, they have them as much as they want. But people can say, like, well, I like this, and I like this, and I like this. They're not restrained to just say, I like this one world. So yeah, I did a lot of experimentation back and forth of like, should there be more? Should there be more of a wrap up? Should there be more of a whatever? But honestly, there's a thing where if you just say like, cut, and you just say, that's it, game's over, we've stopped playing, do what you want. You're basically saying, hey, the embargo on discussion is lifted. We cannot just talk. Everybody feel free to just jump right in, right? If it's still part of a process, people are also like, well, I have to like, follow rules of how we're talking. Like, no, it's just a discussion. Like, and we even do that. We do that between worlds a lot of the times. We'll do one world, and before we jump into the next world, we'll have like a kind of free discussion a little bit. So long as we don't get into what the next world would be. You know, there's a little bit of a debrief, and then we move to the next one. But it's, again, just season to taste. But that giving people freedom, or how to put this, by not having a rule, it is more effective than if I did have a rule, if that made sense. Seeing nods. The audio people can't tell this, but they're nodding. We need little emojis to show that everyone's agreeing. Yes. I'm nodding a lot. I'm gesturing and nodding a lot. No one knows it. So it just sounds like dead silence. Everyone's like, I don't know.
I was just wondering how to, it's just such perfect closing remarks. So there's not much to add to that.
No. Maybe just, Ben, do you have anything to plug? Do you want to highlight anything you're working on? What's coming next?
I'll tell you what I want. Here's what I want in the world. I want more people to be making games like this. Okay, here's a contradiction, right? You think of like the olden days of D&D when it was still a fringe hobby and it was really cool. It's like, before it was really corporate. I guess it was always really corporate, but you know what I mean? And it feels like now the kind of games that I play feel like so fringe, like such a niche of a niche. And every time I see someone who's actually making games like this, I'm like, yeah, awesome. But there's not a lot. There's not a lot of them. So what I'm saying to everyone out there is if you want to get into like a real fringe hobby that's really like still really in the unknown zone, this is for you. This is the place to be. You're on the cutting edge of experimentation. And I'm always looking for new games that people are making because there are a lot of young designers who are making very cool stuff. And I'm always very excited to see it. Very excited to see it. But more. We need more. It's like an anti-plug. It's a request plug. I'm requesting more games.
Yes, absolutely. We're here for that.
And it's kind of the sexy part about our podcast that the indie scene in particular is such an explosion of creativity for such a small audience. It really feels true to that idea. Like 30 years ago, any role-playing game felt like I have to hack it. I have to make it my own. Everybody's a creator.
Yep.
And indie games really feels like that place. Everybody is a creator. Everybody has an interesting idea. And it's just about enabling people to bring them to life.
And the challenge, and I'll say the one other thing, and this is like heart-to-heart talking to the game designers out there. Sometimes you really got to stop and look and really like, you got to put the work in to make the game that will respect people's time, right? Like your people are going to play your game. You want to make a game that they're going to enjoy and get something out. And sometimes there's a rush, like I got an idea, I'm just going to whip it out. And you do. And I've played games like this recently where it's like you just like, oh, this had a good idea, but they didn't really let it percolate. They didn't really pursue it as much as they could have. And I know in my heart, this game is going to get played a couple times and then vanish. Because they didn't, you know what I mean? And it's sad because you're like, no, this game had a great idea to it, a great nugget, but it's never going to break through because it doesn't pay people back for the time they put into playing it, which is terribly unfortunate. So sometimes I think you got to like, as a game designer, I mean, I'm the worst for this. I'll spend gazillions of years working on one game. I'm too much. I'm not a good example. But there is definitely value in like, you gotta sit down with people. You gotta play it. You know, you can't just write it down and send it out. Or you can, but odds are it won't work quite the way you expect and fewer people will play it and they'll be very sad. Cause I want games that people can play. And then you're happy, they're happy, everyone's happy. It's great.
Yeah, I think take your time is a good advice because especially in our hobby, usually it's such a small group, a one-man show thing that if it takes you years, it takes you years, whatever.
Yeah. And even if it's months, I mean, you know, I say years, but it could be honestly just, you know, a couple play sessions will change your whole perspective of a game, particularly playing with people who haven't played or you don't normally play with. If you play with the same group of people all the time, and this is a huge ask, of course, playing with strangers is like, how do you do that? How do you find a bunch of strangers? But I find that playing with people you don't know is wildly educational because you don't have a pre-built social structure that's happening. The game is kind of moderating what happens, which is super useful to them.
Thanks for listening to episode 12 of season 11.
We'd love to read your feedback at hi@3w6.fm or on our Discord server.
If you like this episode, please consider writing a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify.
You can also support us on Patreon.
Until next time.